Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who was the founder of Christianity? While the faith is centered around the redemptive divinity of Jesus, my guest today says Christianity as we know it came into existence through the influence of Paul, the so-called apostle to the Gentiles, who never met Jesus himself, but nevertheless spread ideas about the Jesus as Son of God that came to be codified and reinforced in the Gospels. James D. Tabor is chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and author of the new book, Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity. James, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be with you.
So you explore the idea of Paul being the most influential human being in history, and yet it would seem few Christians understand how much sway he held in shaping what they believe today about Jesus. How has he been able to sort of fly under the radar, even as his name remains quite well known to modern Christians?
Well, you know, I guess if we were doing a poll, people would think of Plato, Moses, Socrates. Certainly Jesus would be high up there, and I think Jesus would probably get the most votes in terms of being the most influential. But then we have to ask, what is our access to Jesus? And so part of it is a chronological point that the Gospels that we associate with Jesus actually come much later than Paul. And so Paul is the under-the-radar, almost hidden influencer of the way Jesus finally gets cast. In other words, Jesus dies in about 30 A.D. Paul flourishes in the 50s, and the Gospels aren't written until the 70s, 80s, 90s. So you've got about a 50-year period from the time of Jesus when his story gets written down. It's not to say there's nothing about Jesus in the Gospels that comes from Jesus, but it's really being cast through a Pauline lens.
Mm. Well, let's take a moment here, and I'll ask you to tell us who Paul was and how he came to consider himself a Christian, having not met Jesus himself.
Well, I think the expression, the Damascus Road experience, is pretty well in our language. This actually comes from the book of Acts in the New Testament, and therefore it's not directly from Paul, it's secondary. But the dramatic story is that Paul was opposed to the Christian movement, that he persecuted the Christian movement. He says that himself in his letters. He says he violently opposed them. And then he had this complete, absolutely shattering experience that he refers to as seeing the Lord. So just as you have at Easter the appearances of the resurrected Jesus, you know, right after Jesus' death, two or three days after on Sunday morning. With Paul, it's several years after, but he equates it as the same experience. In other words, he basically says, I met Jesus, not in the flesh, but in the spirit, and that turned him around. And in the book of Acts, Jesus speaks directly to him by name, Paul, Paul, why do you persecute me? And so that is the tradition that we have about Paul's great turnaround. And, of course, then he joins the movement, but everybody's afraid of him. James and John and Peter and part of the 12 apostles, they're terrified. You know, maybe he's a double agent or maybe he's not really sincere. And so that's the way he comes into the picture in terms of Christianity.
And he saw the mission of Christ as a sort of two-stage plan?
Well, what I present in the book is that he believed that Jesus was sent by God as the Son of God to the Jewish people, to Israel, and even said that the 12 apostles were primarily for the Israelites. And so Jesus is the Jewish Messiah, as we say in the Christmas carol, born as the King of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And then Paul says to Peter and James, the brother of Jesus, and the others in Jerusalem, I'll take the rest of the world. I'll go to the Gentiles. You go to the Jews. And so it's an odd way for us to think today, because we would think it would be the other way around, that you would need a huge team to reach the world and maybe just one or two apostles to reach the Jewish people. But Paul in that time, you have to remember, this is really a Jewish movement. It's not really Christianity per se, but, you know, we've heard of Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes. This particular movement of the followers of Jesus, they were all Jews, would be called the Nazarenes.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're essentially seeing themselves as a messianic movement within Judaism, as a kind of sect of Judaism. Paul comes along and says, well, okay, but I now have a commission to take this to the entire world, meaning to the non-Jewish world. And so that second mission that Jesus never entertained, as far as we know, Jesus didn't go outside the borders of the country and never inaugurated any kind of a universal mission, that's left to Paul. And so he becomes a kind of a second Christ figure, but Christ in the sense of somebody who's been chosen and anointed and sent forth to kind of finish the job.
So tell us, James, about the community that existed in Paul's day among those who had actually known Jesus and continued to follow his teachings. How did they sort of organize themselves and spreading the ideas of Jesus to their fellow Jews in that society?
Well, believe it or not, they were led by someone that people have largely forgotten. They know the name James, but they get it confused with James, one of the 12 apostles. But the one in charge of the movement was actually James, the brother of Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul refers to this in one of his letters, Galatians, where he says, I went up to Jerusalem to meet those who were in Christ before me, he says. And he met Peter, who we know well, the name Peter, and James, he says, the brother of the Lord. And so if we could go back in time to, let's say, the year 30 or 35 or 40, let's call it the Christianity before Paul, it would be very much a Jewish movement within Judaism. It would be a messianic movement. They would be keeping the Torah. They would be keeping the Jewish festivals, Passover, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, all the things that are familiar to us from Judaism, including Hanukkah this week. So they would be following traditional Jewish customs, dietary laws, and so forth. And as a cultural movement, certainly the Romans would see them as another sect of Judaism before Paul comes along and that begins to change. So they would really understand Jesus' mission as to regather a faithful people of Israel, that Israel had drifted away from the ways of God, and that Jesus came. Remember, Jesus is quoted in the Gospels as saying, don't go to the Gentiles, literally says that in the Gospel of Matthew. Only go to the lost sheep, he calls them, of the house of Israel. So it was seen as a very much of a Jewish mission. And even though Gentiles were, I think, welcomed into the movement, they weren't sought after. They were allowed to be almost like associate members or almost hangers-on or adherents to the movement. But there was a controversy as to whether they could really become fully Jewish members.
And what did those messianic Jews who were followers of Jesus, what did they think about Jesus as sort of teacher or savior? Did they understand him to be divine?
You know, this is tricky to know because of what I mentioned earlier in terms of our sources. We have the Gospels, Mark being the earliest, John being the latest, Matthew and Luke in between. And all of those Gospels clearly make Jesus the Son of God, and they clearly say that he's been raised from the dead, and it's understood and even stated in a couple of them that he's been taken up to heaven, he's been exalted. So that's certainly the view of the movement by, let's say, 70, 80, 90 A.D. as we're getting to the turn of the century. But if you go back before Paul, it's not exactly clear, and it's a matter of controversy even among scholars, what were the earliest views of Jesus? Because in Judaism, the Messiah is not God. Divine is kind of a tricky word, as you could imagine,
mm-hmm.
because you could say somebody's the Son of God, but does that really mean, are they God, the way Christians finally come to believe Jesus is God as God is God. He's not the Father, but he's God the Son, which finally becomes part of the Nicene Creed, you know, 300 or 400 years later. So if you go back to, let's say, 40, the year 40, 10 years after Jesus, and try to imagine what they were following, one of the only sources we have would be a document that scholars call the Q document that is embedded in the Gospels. It's a collection of the sayings of Jesus. And although they exalt Jesus, it's not clear that they make him worthy of worship. And that would be one of the questions, because Jews have a very strict idea of the one God. You know, it's the Shema that's quoted in the synagogues daily, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one." And remember, Jesus is quoted as saying to Satan in his great temptation, "You shall worship the Lord your God, him only shall you serve." And when he's called good in our earliest gospel, the Gospel of Mark, somebody comes up and says, "Good teacher, you know, what should I do to have eternal life?" And Jesus seems to rebuke him. He says, "Why are you calling me good? There's only one good, that's God." So there's a side of the tradition that seems to make Jesus the Messiah, make him certainly exalted, and I guess you could say the paramount leader, but not God as God is God. And that begins to come in, I think, later, in some ways beginning with Paul.
Did Paul have any trouble sort of gaining credibility when he said, "I've had these clairvoyant experiences, I continue to have these sort of interactions with Jesus who is no longer walking among us but is communicating with me directly"? Was everybody who was interested in Christianity willing to accept the veracity of what he told them?
I don't think so. In fact, he has to defend very strongly in his letters the veracity of what he's saying, and he gets very worked up about it. He'll say things like, "Before God, I am not lying." You know, almost as we would say today, "I swear that this is true." Mm-hmm. "I've seen the Lord. I received this by a revelation of Jesus Christ." And you have to remember, we only have his side. We don't have the other side. What were people saying to cause him to react so strongly and putting forth his own claims to authority? Now, when I call them clairvoyant experiences, and you know, you're referring partly to my language there, to some, I think, later Christians, that would be offensive, because that would put them in the arena of some kind of psychic experiences or channeling or a seance or something like that. But to the outsider, that's exactly what it would be. In other words, you have somebody that you knew in the flesh, Jesus of Nazareth, a human being who lived on the earth. You had a group of people that knew him, that had spent time with him, that had heard him, that he left behind when he died. And then you have Paul coming along some years later saying, "Well, I'm part of that. Even though I'm last," he says, "I'm not the least. I've also seen the Lord." And so you can see how he could be questioned in terms of, well, you've seen something, but why should we think that you've seen the Lord? Why should we think that what you're getting now should supersede what we had when we were with him? And so you see in his letters some indication of that controversy going on.
James D. Tabor is with us. He is chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and author of the new book, Paul and Jesus, How the Apostles Transformed Christianity. You can be part of the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James D. Tabor. He is chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and author of Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. James, of course, today, if something that we felt was as important as the arrival of a Messiah or a great teacher or, in fact, the Son of God were to arrive among us, we would want to write down and document everything. As you mentioned, at least in terms of what survives, we have very little of that today from the years immediately following the crucifixion. Was that an issue of was it an issue of literacy? Was it an issue of the fact that a lot of people really believed the end of the world was imminent?
I think the latter, and here we are up on the Mayan calendar, but we won't get into that. I really think it's more the latter. It could have been partly literacy, but if you look even at the statements of Jesus, that he says things like, you won't have gone through all the cities of Israel till the Son of Man become, and this generation will not pass till all these things are fulfilled, and you know, John the Baptist says, the axe is now at the root of the tree. And you can just go through the Gospels. I think sometimes people tend to filter this out today because they want to look for things that might be more immediately relevant to the long term. Mm-hmm. But it's in every letter of the New Testament, this kind of excited end of the age, end of the world excitement. And so even in Paul's letters, he tells people not to get married, not because he's against the institution of marriage. He blesses it. But he said, look, in view, the appointed time has grown very short. He even tells engaged couples that if they're planning to get married, and normally we would think an engagement would be, what, a year in advance at the most?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, you know, you ought to consider maybe just staying single because we're of the times that we're living in. And so I really think that was a huge factor. It's probably the most important factor in understanding early Christianity. And it creates a lot of difficulties because what happens then is we try to apply some of that apocalyptic thinking to the longer term. For example, Paul is real controversial about women. He says women should not speak in the assembly. If they have a question, they should ask their husbands. And yet he also says in Christ there's neither male nor female, and he seems to liberate women. And I think he's right up against the clock of the end time, and I think he's saying to slaves, to women, to other people that are in disenfranchised social positions, hold on,
mm-hmm.
very soon it's all going to change, and don't rock the boat right now. But if you try to project that over 100 years, 1,000 years, God forbid 2,000 years, and you institutionalize those strictures, you're actually going against Paul in an odd way because he thinks everything will soon change.
How did Paul give priority to either the facts as he was able to learn them about the historical life and teachings of Jesus as compared with the things that he believed were being revealed to him in these divine encounters?
Well, you know, if you look at his letters, you find these two phrases that are quite similar, but they're phrased, they're worded a little bit differently. He'll say, sometimes I received and I pass it on to you. And that sounds more like I've received this tradition, maybe from Peter or from James, the brother of Jesus. Other times, though, he'll use the same language, I receive, but he'll say, I receive from the Lord. Well, the Lord means Jesus, and Jesus is not there in the flesh. And so he's actually talking about visionary experience. And it doesn't appear to me in reading these different, if you look at all the references to what he's received, I don't think he makes any difference between them. He doesn't differentiate. In other words, he is so convinced that he's talking to Jesus and that Jesus is alive and well and communicating with him that whatever he hears from Jesus, he equates as the latest thing from Jesus, and therefore really above what people might have gotten 10, 15, 20 years before, because they would really be outdated. Almost like the latest word from heaven, you know,
mm-hmm.
that kind of idea.
Yeah.
And that, I think, creates the tension, because the apostles who are with Jesus are going to tend to go by what they experienced with him in their lifetime. And we don't have reports from Peter or James, who is in charge. We have one letter from James in the New Testament. He doesn't report any visions or revelations or anything of that sort. He sounds a lot like Jesus. He'll say, turn the other cheek, love your enemies, you know, do good, care for the poor. Sounds like he's emulating his brother. And so there's a potential tension there that I present in the book. What are you going to believe? In other words, what are you going to follow?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to the phones now. We have Wesley on the line in Dallas. Hi, Wesley.
Hello. I just have a question about, there's been a debate about what they call Pauline primacy, which is kind of a school of thought that says you have to look at Paul first to interpret the gospel narrative instead of going first to the gospel narrative and then reading Paul through that. Have you heard anything about that? What do you think about that?
You know, I haven't heard that exact term. I think historically that's actually correct, but when you meaning that Paul came first, and chronologically I was saying Paul thrives in the 50s A.D., and the Gospels come 70, 80, 90 A.D., so it's another generation. So certainly Paul's influence and teaching is paramount by the time, you know, the Gospels are written. But in terms of going to Paul first, if you're talking in terms of authority, that certainly is how the church ended up. That's why in the beginning of the program, Chris asked me, you know, why would you put Paul as the most influential person in history ahead of Jesus? It would be because we know Jesus through Paul. In other words, it's a lens of Paul. I don't know if that gets right at your question, Wesley, but historically and chronologically, it's the case. But if you're looking at the historical Jesus, you wouldn't necessarily be getting to Jesus by going through Paul.
Is it possible to know whether the Gospels, as written, as influenced by the teachings of Paul, subtract anything that was still known at the time they were being written about the life of Jesus?
Meaning, because of Paul's influence, they
stories
maybe
that were
omitted some things?
Yeah.
Or, well, the people who wrote the Gospels, Mark is the first. He's so, the kind of message he reflects is so parallel to Paul's message. It's hard to know whether he's leaving something out or this is simply how he conceives it. So it's kind of difficult to answer. But he doesn't include this document that I mentioned earlier that we don't really have anymore, the Q document, which is the collection of the sayings of Jesus. Mark doesn't have any of that, and if you go to the book of James, as I alluded to earlier, it sounds a lot like these Sermon on the Mount teachings of Jesus. The Sermon on the Mount that people know pretty well, they've heard phrases from it, none of that is in Mark. And so it is possible that in the earliest presentation of the Gospels, particularly Mark and John, that you're not getting much of what Jesus actually taught, but you're getting more the theology about Jesus, you know, teaching about Jesus rather than teaching of Jesus.
Why did Paul think that it was so important for Christians to fully break from those that had Jewish heritage and Jewish traditions as part of their spiritual practice, to break from that in order to make Christianity something separate?
Well, what he really said publicly, and I'll get to privately, but publicly what he said was, look, if you're a Jew, then you're a Jew, and you follow these things because you're Jewish, but it's not for your salvation. In other words, being a Jew does not help you in God's eyes. Only accepting Christ and the salvation through him helps you. But as far as non-Jews, he did not want them to feel or to think in any way that they had to convert to Judaism. He talks about a new covenant. He talks about no longer being under the Torah. And so for non-Jews, he's very strong that they, it's not so much that they break with it as they simply don't come under the thumb of Jewish authority. And they have their own version of what he calls Abrahamic faith. Now, what he said privately, we're not sure of, because he himself says that when I'm around Jews, I'm like a Jew, but when I'm around non-Jews, I'm like a non-Jew. That could be seen as hypocritical, or it could be seen as strategic, meaning he doesn't really think it matters, but he doesn't want to offend people. So if he's around Jews, he's not going to ask for a piece of bacon. But if he's around non-Jews, does he really care, even though he's Jewish? And that's kind of the debate about Paul. Is he fluid in his convictions on things that he doesn't think are major points in God's eyes?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with Olivia in Dallas. Hi, Olivia.
Hey there. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
Okay, my question is about earlier comment that you made concerning that Jesus told the disciples not to go outside the Jewish faith. And if that's true, what do you do with the Great Commission where he said, go into all the world and preach the gospel?
Well, what you have really, the, both of those sayings are in Matthew, and the one I quoted earlier, don't preach to the Gentiles and so forth, is earlier in Matthew, and at the end of Matthew, as you know, the Great Commission is the last verse or two, he's recorded as saying, go into all the world. The question then becomes, is that really Jesus that's saying this, or is that a Pauline version of Jesus? In other words, is that written later, putting back into the mouth of Jesus the thoughts of Paul? Now, for more conservative, fundamentalist readers of the Bible, that's not an option. You know, whatever the Bible says, and that's just it. But critical scholars usually look at the Gospels as a composite. That is, you've got early tradition and later tradition, and that universalism of going into all the world is something we know first in Paul. And so the question of whether Jesus actually said that, and especially, as you know, it says, baptize in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, that starts sounding not like Jesus. It doesn't sound like the Jesus, the Jew that we know in other parts of the Gospels, but it starts sounding like a kind of Christian ecclesiastical language. And so most scholars would question whether that's really from the mouth of Jesus. You see what I'm saying, Olivia?
Let's bring her back on.
Okay.
Olivia, does that make sense?
Yes, I guess just because it doesn't sound like him, although that's not really hard evidence that he didn't say it.
Yeah, look, if one assumes that everything in the Gospels claimed to be from Jesus is from Jesus, then you're in a completely different arena from, say, the historians with any historical source who try to sift through it and determine what is more likely or less likely to come from the person that's being recorded as saying this or that. It's kind of a critical view rather than a fundamentalist view.
What happens when you apply a historical lens to what has been recorded about the Last Supper?
Well, that's really, really interesting because Paul is our earliest witness to the Last Supper, not the Gospels. Everybody goes to Mark and Matthew and Luke, where Jesus takes bread and says, this is my body, and he takes the cup and says, this is my blood. So you have the Holy Communion or the Mass. But Paul is actually the first one to record that in 1 Corinthians 11. And what he says is most interesting. He said, I received this from the Lord, meaning he got it from Jesus, presumably, because Jesus is no longer around physically, the Jesus of his heavenly visions. And this is what he passes on, and this is what ends up in the Gospels. So it's very close to Olivia's question. If you open the Gospels and say, look, anything I read in here, if it says Jesus said it, then Jesus said it. You know, I'm done. That's just it. Then there's no critical lens. But if you take a critical lens, we have another document. It's called the Didache. It's from around turn of the century, first century. And it has a Last Supper also in which the bread is not the body and the cup is not the blood of Jesus, which would be seen by Jews as kind of a cannibalism, you know, eating flesh and drinking blood even symbolically would be really distasteful, I think, in Jewish culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to ask whether Paul might have introduced this practice and then it got into the Gospels and was attributed to Jesus. Now, I know for many Christians, that's just heretical and that's, you know, completely outlandish, and how could you even think such a thing? But what I do in the book is not so much take a position on that as you could call this book Paul in His Own Words. And Paul in his own words says, I got this from the Lord. So what you have to decide is, do you accept that what Paul said he got from Jesus is Jesus, or do you not accept that? And if you don't accept it, then you would have to go to other sources to get Jesus.
We have an email here.
It's complex.
We have an email here from Megan in Carrollton, who wants to know if you think all the books attributed to Paul were actually written by Paul. Do you feel Paul's message shifts, perhaps with the age of Paul himself? He seems to mellow over time.
Yeah, actually, I have at the end of the book a chapter called The Quest for the Historical Paul. And it turns out in the New Testament, again, according to most of us, we scholars who work in this field, that we've got three layers of Paul. We've got early Paul, which all of us agree is authentically Paul, seven letters. But he's attributed, 13 letters are attributed to him. And so the rest of the letters fall into two camps, and some of them are rather late. And most of us do not think they're word for word from Paul. They're influenced by some of Paul's thought. But as your email writer indicates, whether you'd call them mellow or not, I think they actually become harsher in some cases, like the strictures against women and their participation become much more rigid than in the early letters of Paul. But it could be that in other ways Paul seems to be realizing that the end of his life is near, and maybe he mellows in that sense, that maybe he's not going to live to see the end.
James D. Tabor is with us. He is chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. His new book is called Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Investing in your education can pay big dividends. SMU Certificate Program in Financial Planning could help. You can earn a CFP certificate at SMU starting in January. Details online at cfp.smu.edu.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James D. Tabor. He is chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and author of the new book, Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. James, to the extent that in the early decades after the crucifixion, there was this sort of ongoing tension between James and Peter and the Jewish followers of Jesus and Paul and his ideas, why did Paul ultimately sort of win out to the extent that his ideas were to influence the Gospels as they came along and then really most, if not all, of Christianity that would follow?
I think it's due to a political event that took place. The Romans utterly destroyed Jerusalem in the Jewish-Roman revolt, was 66 to 70 AD. And by that time, Peter's dead, James is dead, Paul is dead. So you've got this whole new generation that doesn't have the connection, and all of those Jewish followers of Jesus are gone, dead, scattered, forgotten, so that Paul's letters, I call it in the book a kind of literary triumph, to have these very impressive letters from the 50s as the only literature that begins to get circulated among Gentile churches just gives him a status that he probably could have never anticipated even in his own life. From what we can tell in his own life, toward the end, he says he's all alone, that people have forsaken him, that he's looking only to God, and he has a few faithful followers that he can call upon. But it seems like he thinks at the end that he might have even failed. But then those letters that are just very impressive, I think, in terms of literature even today, you know, a book like Romans is so well written, even in the style of Greek, that it really ensures his legacy when there was nothing else.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to David in Nevada. Hi, David.
Yes, thank you for the interesting show and the fascinating guest.
Welcome.
Throughout the millennia, there have been certain traits of humankind that are common even today, and one of them is the malleability of memories, especially when they're 70 years old, fourth or fifth hand. So this is a historical studies technical question, if you will. We know of many historical events. Let's use the example of, say, the American Civil War. That's probably not a good one to use when speaking of a Semitic population, where we know with good accuracy of a historical event during that time. And then we can find testimony and accounts written by people 60 and 70 years later. Has anyone considered looking at Paul in the Gospels, studying as how these people's accounts actually varied from the actual event, and then looking at Paul in the Gospels, assuming the same amount of variability? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, if I got the question, that is what we try to do with the historical study of early Christianity. That's what I do as part of my field, and many of us in the academic study of religion, not so much theology, but we work as historians. And we try our best to use normal historical methods. In other words, if we're studying Abraham Lincoln, or we're studying Socrates, or Alexander the Great, or Jesus of Nazareth, we would not change the methodology that we would apply. The problem is sources. Obviously, your Civil War example, we've got letters, photographs, contemporary eyewitness accounts, such a wealth of material. But even with that, you know, look at your latest biographies of Lincoln. You can have a completely different Lincoln presented by one author, one historian, from another, or Lyndon Johnson, or any figure even of our own time. So if you go back to Jesus, it's really compounded. And one of the quests for the past 150 years in academics has been the quest for the historical Jesus. How close have we gotten? I think I would like to be optimistic about our field and say that Paul's letters are really one of our best sources, but they have to be read critically. But they do seem to come from that time within 20, 30 years after he lived.
James, today it is of great importance to many Christians that they feel that they have the exact words of Jesus in, particular stories or examples within the Bible as translated into whatever language they might speak. Was this of the utmost importance also to the early followers of Jesus, or were the ideas and the philosophies and the sort of teachings more important than the exact phrasing?
I think we can show absolutely that the phrasing is not as exact as it would be to people today, because Matthew is rewritten Mark, and Luke is rewritten Matthew and Mark. In other words, these Gospels rewrite one another, and if you put them side by side, as some people have done, make a kind of synoptic Gospel parallel edition.
And synoptic is where you line them all up and sort of look for...
Exactly. Yeah. You see huge variations in the expressions and words, and sometimes even in the main point that's being made, but a kind of fluidity in terms of expression. And then we get the Gospel of Thomas, which comes later, which has some of those traditions, but others. And I know it's upsetting to people sometimes to have to face this, some of my students, in fact, but as we go through the Gospels trying to see what the process of transmission was, it does seem to that in the ancient world, they were more interested in orality, that is, the storytelling aspect, than getting every word and every phrase exactly verbatim.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next with Heather in Fort Worth. Hi, Heather.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is going back a little bit to a comment that he had made earlier. I was wondering if you could just clarify on your views of Paul's view of, and maybe his contemporaries' view of his authority. Because he seems, as compared with the earlier apostles, because he seems in the Acts and in his own letters to even submit himself to their authority in several cases, going back to the Council of Jerusalem, et cetera. And I was wondering if you could comment more on that.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for the question, Heather. You know, if you go by the book of Acts, Paul seems much more subservient to the authorities at Jerusalem, but we also have his own account of those events in the book of Galatians. And there, because he's talking to his own people, kind of like an aside that maybe he thinks nobody else is going to read, he's very, very different. He says, I went up to Jerusalem, I saw James, I saw Peter, and he says, the so-called pillars of the church. And then he adds, parenthetically, what they are means nothing to me. And I don't think he means that he hates them or dislikes them. What he wants to say is, look, I don't get my authority from them. And so in the book of Acts, we have to be very careful. It's a much later source. And I think we always should favor what Paul himself says. And what he says is that he made an agreement with them, but shortly after that, he says that he denounced Peter to his face and stood up in front of a whole group and told him he was not acting properly. And so there is a lot more that apparently went on. You think of Acts as more the later story for the outsiders. It's almost like in a family, if there's a family feud, you don't have to air that to the neighbors. But if you're talking among yourselves, you know, you're allowed to speak rather frankly. And so I think in his letters, we get that other side, and I try to bring that out in the book.
You say that the book of Acts is probably, and this is a quote, the most misleading document in the New Testament canon.
It's the most misleading document if you take it as a verbatim account from the time that it relates, meaning it begins to tell you what happened in the years and decades right after Jesus, but it's written in the 70s, 80s, or 90s AD. So if you take it as a verbatim account, you're going to get misled, as I just said, because you're reading a harmonizing, peaceful account of what went on rather than what actually went on at the time, as you would have with his letters. So you really got to compare the two.
Which, again, to go back to our now sort of overdone example of the Civil War, it's not so different than the way sometimes we portray the heroes in our own sort of political history. Initially, we might gloss over some of the more complicated realities.
Absolutely. Stone has his new series on Showtime, isn't it, called, you know, What Really Happened in American History or something like that. It would be very similar to that. That we have a view of Roosevelt, we have a view of Truman, we have a view of World War II, but then what actually is the part that we weren't told in third or fourth or fifth grade history class? And that would be similar. But with Paul, because we have his letters, and he does not hold back in his letters from pretty well telling you what he thinks, it's a precious resource for people that study early Christianity. It's kind of like the good, the bad, and the ugly. You get it all with Paul.
Would Christianity as we have it today have survived, or I guess it would be a different Christianity had there been no Paul?
You know, it's really hard to know from a divine point of view. I guess people would say, of course it would, because Jesus is God's son, and God would have made sure it triumphed. But if you look at it just historically, Jesus never wrote anything. He didn't go outside the borders. And what would the Gospels have been like without Paul? It's really hard for us to imagine. And I think we have to ask that as a question. Would it have just remained a sect within Judaism? And like Pharisees, Sadducees, and Essenes, kind of merged into the fog of history? It's possible.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Pepper in Plano. Hi, Pepper.
Hi there, and thank you so much for such an excellent show. The author, James Taver, in doing this for, I think, especially me, I was raised as a Catholic and never memorized the Bible. We had readings in the Mass, of course, but I am a pariah to my friends because I said, in my own opinion, that the Gospels are recollections of men long after Jesus had died. And I'm so excited to read this book because you're actually doing what I've wanted to do my whole life, and that is actually be a historian like you are, to get the facts down from all the Jewish chronicles and everything about what really happened. And thank you,
Pepper. I look forward to email me and tell me what you think once you read it.
Are you still hopeful that new documents will surface that will clear up the remaining questions that you and other historians have? I mean, I know these things are few and far between, but we do hear every few years of something new that has emerged.
We do. I mean, I mentioned the Didache, this non-Pauline version of Christianity that surfaced around the 1890s. I mean, you just never know. You can hope. And what we like most are new texts and new materials. Mm-hmm. So. Maybe, but I do archaeology too. If you go looking, you probably won't find it. And when you're not even looking, something might turn up, like the Dead Sea Scrolls.
And then
I've got a blog, by the way, Chris, jamestabor.com, where I cover more of all these things. So I wanted to just mention that.
Oh, great. And Tabor is
T-A-B-O-R. Jamestabor.com, T-A-B, okay. B as in boy. T-A-B-O-R.
The last thing I want to talk briefly to you about is when new documentation is discovered, then the challenge is figuring out, A, what you've got, and then B, I guess then you're on the hunt for a whole new set of historical details and background information to put that in context.
Yeah, dating it, determining if it's authentic. Remember the Jesus wife thing, what was it, 2 or 3 months ago that made headlines?
Right.
Scholars began to doubt whether it was authentic or not. And so you have this whole series of questions that you have to go through. Now, if we found something authentically dated from the first century, from this period we're talking about, like the New Testament, that would be earth-shaking. I mean, that would be like the Dead Sea Scrolls. But so far, that has never come up. All of these things that have been found tend to be 2nd, 3rd, and 4th century, and you just wonder if anything else has survived, and will it ever be found?
James D. Tabor is chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte and author of the new book, Paul and Jesus, How the Apostle Transformed Christianity. You can find his blog at jamestabor, is it .com or .org?
.com.
James, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I really appreciate it.
Great to be with you, Chris. Good questions. I appreciated it. Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Alan Roberts. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer with help today from Lindsay Connect. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast for free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions. Email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.